Hey, Morbidology listeners. Before we get on with today's episode, could I please request that you don't judge Morbidology on the early episodes? I'd recommend maybe listening from the newer ones backwards, because I honestly didn't find my feet in podcasting for quite some time. The quality of the early episodes, as well as the hosting, is not a true representation of Morbidology today, and I'm currently in the process of redoing them all. If you do listen to the earlier episodes, please don't judge the show on them, and maybe give a newer one a listen before deciding if the show is for you. Thank you so much for all of your support, and now on with the show. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Filicide is the deliberate act of a parent killing their own child. 61% of child murders where the victim is under 5 years old are committed by one of the victim's parents. Therefore, when a child is murdered, the parents are very often the first suspect. When a child goes missing, the community really comes together in a desperate bid to bring that child home safely. Unfortunately, however, not all of these children make it back home. This story takes place in South Amboy, New Jersey, and spans over 25 years. 5-year-old Timothy William Wiltsey, or Timmy, as he was affectionately known by his loved ones, lived in a modest home with his 23-year-old single mother, Michelle Lodzinski. Michelle worked as a secretary for an Addison firm, while Timmy's father, George Wiltsey, wasn't in the picture. He and Michelle had separated when Timmy was just 6 months old, and following their separation, George moved to Walker in Iowa and never had any contact with his young son. Timmy was a student at St. Mary Elementary School, and those who knew him recalled that he was mostly timid and shy. He had a peculiar quirk of sleeping with his sneakers on, and he adored his cat, Norton, who slept in his bed each night. In the mornings, Timmy liked to wake up and wait for Norton to attack his feet from under the covers. Timmy also loved the ice cream man and fire trucks. Unfortunately, however, Timmy never got the chance to reach his full potential. It was a pleasant spring evening on the 25th of May, 1991, when a Sayreville police officer was approached by Michelle in the Sayreville Carnival, which was being held just across the town line. She told the officer that she and Timmy had been attending the carnival when Timmy disappeared. Michelle told police that it was approximately 7:30 p.m. when she momentarily left Timmy to go and buy some soda at the nearby concession stand. She said that when she returned to where she left Timmy, he was gone. Sayreville police halted the carnival so that they could search the area. It wouldn't be long until over 300 concerned citizens offered their assistance in the grueling search for Timmy. These dedicated volunteers combed through the empty carnival and trudged through nearby woodlands, dumpsters, storm sewers, while the carnival trailers were searched. State police scoured the area in a helicopter while a diving unit searched the nearby ponds. The search continued throughout the night, and at around 1 a.m, Michelle went home. She was driven home by a Sayreville police officer who later recollected that she was extremely quiet throughout the journey. When they approached Michelle's home, her ex-boyfriend, Fred Bruno, was already waiting on the front porch. Fred and Michelle had been in an on and off again relationship, which eventually fell apart because Fred didn't want to get serious with a woman who had a young son. By the time Michelle arrived home, Fred had already been informed that there was an emergency, but nobody had yet elaborated what that emergency was. When Michelle got out of the police car, she told Fred that Timmy had vanished from the carnival. The following morning, Michelle was back at the carnival, assisting in the search for her son.
If anybody finds anything, an article of clothing, bones, body parts, I know it sounds gruesome, but if you find anything, stop.
Instructions from one volunteer to others as people come from miles around and all walks of life in search of a missing child.
A number of volunteers couldn't help but notice that Michelle seemed particularly nonchalant. They reasoned that everybody reacts differently to traumatic experiences and didn't think too much of it at the time. Missing person flyers for Timmy were circulated to every state in the nation. These posters described Timmy as being 3 feet 3 inches tall, 45 to 50 pounds, with a brown crew cut and brown eyes. On the evening of his disappearance, he was wearing a red tank top, knee-length shorts, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle sneakers. Identifying features included a slight scar on his right cheek and chin from a dog bite. The photograph of Timmy that was used on the missing person flyers was one that was taken for his upcoming graduation, which was scheduled for just a few weeks later. In less than a week, over 50,000 flyers were plastered on doorways, windows, and signposts throughout the state of New Jersey. Timmy's smiling face, frozen in time, was even featured on milk cartons nationwide. The case garnered national attention immediately and would feature on America's Most Wanted, along with a recent video recording of Timmy at a birthday party, so the viewers could get a better glimpse of how Timmy truly looked. The following week, 25,000 railroad workers in 13 different states received copies of Timmy's missing person flyer included in their paychecks, while truckers, picking up shipments from rail yards, would also get flyers to distribute along the highways on their route.
The disappearance of the 5-year-old boy has prompted a nationwide search. 25,000 Conrail employees in 13 states are receiving flyers on Timmy, and last night his face was flashed across the screen at Yankee Stadium. But no search is as heartfelt as the one in his hometown of South Amboy.
The first person to be ruled out in the disappearance was George, Timmy's father. George had been at home over 500 miles away at the time of the disappearance, and he had several people who were able to corroborate his alibi. As mentioned at the beginning of this episode, parents are always the first suspect when it comes to missing children, and George was quickly ruled out as a suspect. Fred, Michelle's ex-boyfriend, was also ruled out as a suspect early on. In the days following the disappearance, Michelle's parents, Ed and Alice, made tearful appeals for the safe return of Timmy. Michelle, on the other hand, was much more reluctant to grant interviews. By the end of the month, Michelle's account as to what had happened on the evening that Timmy disappeared had started to crumble. Investigators were unable to corroborate her claims when they were unable to find any witnesses who saw Timmy at the carnival that evening. Investigators were now focusing on the time between 1 p.m. when Timmy was last seen at home by a neighbour and 7:30 p.m. when he was reported missing.
She said that on the day that Timmy disappeared, they had earlier been at a park in Holmdel. She took Timmy there to see the animals, and then later that day, around 7 o'clock, she went to this carnival, I believe it's Kennedy Park in Sarahville, and she arrived there around 7 o'clock in the evening.
According to Michelle, she and Timmy had spent some time at Holmdel Park in Monmouth County before going to the carnival. One witness at the carnival that evening did come forward with some information, but they had a different version of events to Michelle. According to Laura Machowski, she spoke to Michelle at the carnival, but Michelle was alone. Timmy wasn't with her, nor did she mention him or seem distressed. Laura later called police to detail what she had witnessed after reading about the controversial case in the local newspaper. Within weeks of the disappearance, locals and law officials alike would begin to question Michelle's story. She received much criticism for her apparent cavalier attitude towards her only son's disappearance. When pupils from Timmy's school arrived at her door to present her with $700 that they had collected to go towards a reward fund, Michelle refused to even come outside. Instead, her mother accepted the money and spoke with the pupils as well as the number of reporters that had gathered outside to witness what they had anticipated would be an emotional moment. Michelle said that she refused to play into the public's anticipation of a mother crying for her child. The reason behind her attitude, she claimed, was because she didn't want Timmy to see her behaving distraught if he was watching television somewhere. Another peculiarity with Michelle's behaviour was when the owner of a mail order business offered to place Timmy's photograph on items that he published free of charge. He asked Michelle if he could have a photograph of Timmy, and she promised she would bring one down. However, no such photograph ever arrived. You would think that the offer of free publicity would be an opportunity that the mother of a missing child would not turn down. Maybe there was a reason Michelle was acting so bizarre. In fact, everybody would soon discover that Michelle had already changed her story as to what had happened on that fateful evening several times, and had been under intense interrogation by investigators. Michelle had originally told police that she turned her back on Timmy to get a soda and had discovered him missing when she turned around. However, when she was brought in for questioning again on the 6th of June, this time she offered a different sequence of events.
That Timmy was on a ride, and when she looked away, a man was taking him off the ride after it stopped. And he told her, "Stay away or I will hurt him," and he joined another man. They were walking away from her.
She told investigators this time that Timmy had been kidnapped by two men at knife point. Investigators attempted to press Michelle for more information regarding this alleged kidnapping. Her son was still missing, and this new information she had finally revealed suggested a break in the case. If this were true, one would think that Michelle would want to cooperate and see these kidnappers apprehended as soon as possible and her son returned home safely. However, Michelle became infuriated with their questioning and stormed out of police headquarters. Several days later, Michelle returned to the police headquarters and told investigators that she had made the earlier statement up. Understandably, the investigators were stunned. Here was this woman in front of them. Her young son is still missing, and she was wasting precious time by fabricating ludicrous stories. The following morning, Michelle returned to police headquarters once again. This time, her story had changed once more. Forget what she said before. Michelle was now claiming that a woman named Ellen had offered to watch Timmy while she went to the concession stand to pick up some soda. Michelle told the investigators that she knew Ellen from back when she was a bank teller. She said that Ellen was a go-go dancer who used to cash welfare checks at the bank where she worked. She further stated that Ellen was with two men and that after she started to walk towards the concession stand, one of the men pulled out a knife and threatened to murder Timmy if she screamed.
That while there, she had purchased some tickets to put Timmy on one of the rides there. And while there, she met with a girl whom she knew. Her name was Ellen, and she was accompanied by her daughter, which she said was about 2 or 3 years old, and two other people, two other white males. She said that she wanted to get a drink, a soda, and Ellen said to her that I'll put Timmy on the ride and you go ahead and get your drink. While she was going to the confectionery stand, I believe it was, to get a soda, one of the two men that were with Ellen came up to her, put her hand around her shoulders, and threatened her with a knife. She said at first she was frightened, and then she kind of thought that it was just a joke. When she turned around and looked, and Timmy was still there at the ride, so she continued on to the confectionery stand to get the soda.
What did she tell you happened after the man threatens her with the knife?
Well, she said that he threatened her with a specific type of knife, which was described as being a pocket knife. Mm-hmm. And he said to her that you have a nice looking son. If you don't want anything to happen to him, then you should continue on and don't return.
Ellen and the two men then allegedly fled the carnival, trailing Timmy behind them. Understandably, investigators took this claim very seriously, but despite an extensive FBI search, no such Ellen was ever found. In addition to her ever-changing version of events, Michelle had failed several polygraph tests that had been administered by the investigators. They even noted that her attitude to these tests was nothing short of disinterested. Her behavior and her numerous versions of events just confirmed to them what they already believed, that Michelle was the lead suspect in her own son's disappearance. As it turned out, Michelle had also told Fred a different version of events.
The story changed from the May 25th, from that night. It changed. She left a voicemail on my answer machine to call her. That was important that I speak to her. And I called her back a little while later, and she had told me a different story than what she said previously on the 25th.
What did she tell you this time?
She had said that she was at the carnival with Timmy, and there was a woman there with a man and a little girl. And Timmy was on a ride, and she ran out of money, and she wanted to go get more money at her car. So for some reason, the woman, the man, the child, and Timmy all walked to her car, she had told me. And she said that when they were at the car, the woman pulled a knife and put it to Timmy, and she took him in the car and they drove off. And it left me a little bit perplexed. And I had asked what kind of car was it, or she didn't know, and I asked the color of the car, and she said it was a red car. I said, did you get a license plate number? She said, no. The story just all sounded kind of odd to me. I said, did you scream? Did you call the police? Did you yell for anybody? I said, usually there's police officers, crossing the street, you know, with the carnival people, you know, letting you cross the street. I said, did you tell them? And she said, no. I said, did you scream for help? She said, no. I said, anything. She said, no, I was afraid they were going to hurt him.
Fred later told police that around 2 weeks after Timmy disappeared, Michelle told him that he had been kidnapped. She told Fred that when she went back to the car to get money, she was approached by the woman she identified as Ellen. In this version of events, Ellen was with a man and a young girl. As the months dragged by, locals and investigators alike attempted to remain optimistic, but they really started to consider the likelihood that Timmy was dead. The tips had come to a standstill, and it really seemed as though Timmy had just vanished into thin air. But then in October, around 5 months after the disappearance, there was a massive breakthrough in the case. Daniel O'Malley, a teacher at Brown Burk High School, had been at the Raritan Centre Business Park in Edison, New Jersey. He had been attending a sports memorabilia expo with a friend. Both men were avid bird watchers and had a keen interest in swamp amphibians. Following the expo, they decided to walk towards the marshland off Olympic Drive. While walking along a desolate freight rail line, Daniel discovered a child sneaker. Upon further inspection, he noticed that the little sneaker had a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle print on the side. Daniel recalled seeing the missing person posters of Timmy plastered around the area, which included a description of his sneakers, which had a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle print. Daniel rushed back to his car and placed the sneaker in a sandwich bag that he had left on the back seat. He drove directly to Sayreville Police Headquarters, where a young officer took the sneaker and listened to Daniel's story. He wrote a police report, but never actually asked Daniel where he had found the sneaker. Police sent the sneaker to the FBI lab to be tested. Those results came back as inconclusive, so the sneaker was sent back and placed on a shelf in Sayreville Police Headquarters, where it was quietly forgotten about for the forthcoming 6 months. Daniel waited and waited to hear back from police. When no call ever came, Daniel decided to contact a local newspaper and told them about the sneaker that he had found. After the newspaper published the story, Ron Butkiewicz, an FBI agent who had recently been assigned to Timmy's case, contacted Daniel and asked him if he could direct him to where he found the sneaker. Since the sneaker was found in a relatively secluded area that didn't have many houses nearby, Officer Butkiewicz was certain that it belonged to Timmy. However, when the sneaker was shown to Michelle, she took one quick glance at it and said that she had never seen the sneaker before in her life. She was adamant that the sneaker did not belong to her son. Nevertheless, Officer Butkiewicz decided that he would re-interview Michelle's friends and family. These interviews would reveal some interesting information that would pique the interest in Michelle as a suspect once again. A number of people who knew Michelle and Timmy told them that they were stunned to hear about the discovery of the sneaker. They told investigators that the reason they were so surprised was because Michelle had previously worked at the Raritan Center Business Park, where the sneaker was found. When investigators had earlier asked Michelle for her complete employment history, she had purposefully omitted this location. According to Officer Butkiewicz, "At that moment, I was dead certain that the boy's body was there.
I decided to organize a search of Raritan Center for the boy's remains."
"And why did you do that?"
"Well, there was a number of factors, actually. The first thing was the sneaker. That was a mystery whether or not it could be the boy's sneaker. And also knew about Michelle Lidzinski herself giving several different versions of what had occurred. I knew from talking to other law enforcement people, pardon me, who had interviewed her, that her demeanor was at times hostile, sometimes vulgar. She had left an interview. As an investigator, that gets your attention. That's why she was a suspect prior to me even getting the case. From my investigation, once a case was assigned to me and I knew exactly where the sneaker was found by Mr. O'Malley, this was an isolated, desolate area. Anybody doing something that didn't want to be seen, this is a place to do it. And when I found out that Florida Fulfillment is literally around the corner, a 5, maybe 10 minute walk away, my suspicion that she murdered her son and dumped the body where we found it went right off the charts."
If there was any hope that Timmy was still alive. It was shattered on the 23rd of April, 1992. Officer Bud Kiewit had organized a search of the area surrounding the Raritan Center Business Park following the interviews with Michelle's friends and family.
Chronologically, the first thing found, literally in less than a minute after we lined up and started the formal search, was the second sneaker. And it was the corresponding shoe to the one that had previously been found. The first one, my recollection is, was a left shoe, and the one we found was the right shoe. Same logo, pattern, everything. And it was found within 20, 30 yards of the first shoe.
It didn't take them long to discover the second matching sneaker, approximately 20 to 30 yards from where the first sneaker was found. Also nearby, they found a blue and white blanket and Timmy's clothes. The search didn't stop there. Shortly thereafter, they made a grim discovery alongside piles of trash and animal feces. They found a small skull and human remains partially submerged in a stream which flows to the Raritan River.
And a few hours later, a skull was found by one of the New Jersey State Police people. And I found what appeared to me to be either be a blanket or a fragment of a blanket or a section of a blanket within 20 feet or so of where the skull was. Something similar to a pillowcase or a pillowcase itself was found, again, in the general vicinity of where the sneakers were.
By the following morning, the small skull was identified as Timmy's through dental records. Middlesex County Prosecutor Robert Guck announced that his death was being treated as a homicide. However, the way that Timmy met his demise will always remain a mystery. Due to advanced decomposition, a cause of death could never be determined. The cloud of suspicion that Michelle was under beforehand now doubled, and investigators announced that Michelle still hadn't been ruled out as a suspect, adding that nobody had corroborated her story. Investigators had trawled through footage and photographs from other carnival goers in the hopes that Timmy could be spotted in the background, but to no avail. Another inconsistency came to light when Michelle was speaking about Holmdel Park, where she claimed that she and Timmy had spent the afternoon before attending the carnival. Michelle had told investigators that she had parked in a specific parking lot, but as it turned out, this particular parking lot was closed on that day. While, of course, it goes without saying that everybody deals with grief differently, Michelle's reaction to the revelation that her son had been murdered was remarkably cool. She asked no questions about how or where he was found. She didn't even ask his cause of death, or whether or not he had suffered. On the 12th of May, Timmy was laid to rest at St. Joseph Cemetery following a funeral mass at St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church. During the ceremony, friends and family members alike observed that Michelle seemed disinterested and even blasé. By the following week, many of Michelle's supporters would turn against her and see her in a different light. Before now, the public had no idea that Michelle had changed her story as to what happened to Timmy several times. Nevertheless, there was just never enough evidence to charge Michelle with the murder of her son, and eventually, questioning by investigators stopped. By mid-July, the case had dropped from the headlines and Michelle packed up her things and left South Amboy to move to Woodbridge. Despite the fact that Timmy was no longer in the media, nobody forgot about him. On the 22nd of January, 1994, the headlines of the Star Ledger read, "Mother of slain boy reported missing." A year and a half had passed since Timmy's skull was discovered, and now Michelle was back in the media once again. Michelle's empty and locked car had been discovered outside her brother's apartment in Woodbridge, with the engine running. She had left for work at around 7 a.m., but never arrived. At lunchtime, Michelle's brother Edward noticed her abandoned car sitting outside and called police. The following morning, Michelle was found in Detroit. She claimed that two law enforcement agents had abducted her in a black car and dropped her off in Detroit. According to Michelle, these two men had warned her to keep silent about Timmy's murder. Michelle's claims were extremely perplexing and far-fetched. Michelle had remained silent about Timmy's murder. His name hadn't been in the newspapers for well over a year. In fact, most people in Michelle's new life weren't even aware that Michelle ever had a son, let alone a son who was murdered, and his murder remained unsolved. After extensive questioning, Michelle was unable to substantiate her story. She was charged with staging her own abduction. Evidence showed that Michelle had actually caught a bus to Detroit that morning and fabricated the entire abduction story. She was sentenced to 6 months house arrest and 3 years probation. She was also ordered to seek counselling and apologise to federal authorities. This wasn't the only run-in that Michelle had with law enforcement. In December of 1997, while Michelle was pregnant with her second child, she pleaded guilty to stealing a laptop from her former employer, Banksy & Snyder Services, Incorporated, where she had worked as a receptionist. She was sentenced to house arrest and probation. In 1998, Michelle moved to Florida before moving to Minnesota and getting married to a man named Harold. She soon fell pregnant with her third child. Over the forthcoming years, Michelle lived a life of anonymity. Every now and then, a reporter would wait outside her home in the quaint Apple Valley, just 9 miles south of Minneapolis, hoping to catch a glimpse of the main suspect in Timmy's murder. As Michelle drove into the driveway of her suburban home in her white Jeep Cherokee, she looked the very picture of a suburban housewife with her placid nuclear family. Michelle's neighbours knew nothing of her sordid past, and she wanted to keep it that way. Unbeknownst to Michelle, however, Sayreville police periodically review cold cases, and one day, Timmy's would be up for review. On what would have been Timmy's 29th birthday, Michelle was arrested for his murder. At the time of Michelle's arrest, her marriage with Harold had broken down and she had moved back to Florida with her two children. When the case was handed to grand jury to review, it was determined that there was enough evidence for Michelle to be sent to trial for Timmy's murder. A judge ordered that Michelle would not be allowed to post bond and would stay in a Florida jail until she had to be extradited back to New Jersey. In September, Michelle appeared in court to plead not guilty to the murder of her son. During this hearing, prosecutors revealed some of the new evidence that led to the arrest of Michelle. When Timmy's remains were discovered, investigators had failed to show some of the items that were found at the crime scene to people who could potentially identify them. The blue and white blanket had been shown to Michelle, and she claimed she had never seen it before. However, when the case was reopened to review, investigators tracked down Timmy's cousin, Jennifer Blair Dilcher, who had often babysat Timmy when she was a teenager. Jennifer started shaking uncontrollably when shown the blanket. She said that she recognized it immediately as the one she used to snuggle up with Timmy. It was the identification of the blanket combined with a further review of the evidence that led prosecutors to present the case to a grand jury. The trial was scheduled for March of 2016. Now, it was time for the prosecution and the defense to build their cases. The moment that many investigators and locals alike had been anticipating for 25 long years finally rolled around on the 16th of March, 2016.
I heard what everyone else heard. And what everyone else heard and saw was that there was this little handsome kid in our neighborhood. He was a good-looking kid. And at the end of the day, the picture that stays in my mind the most was the skull of your son in a ditch with animal feces on it. I'll never forget that.
During the opening statement, Assistant County Prosecutor Christine Lavaca said, "The evidence will show that it was his mother, Michelle Lodzinski, the very person who brought him into the world, took him out of it." Former Sayreville police officer Kevin Skolnick was the first to take the stand. He told the courtroom that Michelle was completely blasé when she reported her son missing from the carnival. She didn't appear to be distraught or worried, and certainly didn't elicit the emotions one would expect of a mother whose son was missing. At the core of the prosecution's case was the faded blue and white blanket that was found just yards away from Timmy's skeletal remains. The following day, another former babysitter for Timmy, Danielle Girding, took to the stand. Danielle was the second babysitter to identify the blanket found with Timmy's remains as the same one she had seen numerous times inside Michelle's home. This piece of evidence was the smoking gun. If the blanket had come from inside Michelle's home, then how did it get to the crime scene? If Michelle had claimed that Timmy was abducted from home, then she could have argued that whoever abducted Timmy could have stolen the blanket. However, since Michelle claimed that Timmy was abducted from the carnival, then how exactly did the blanket get to the crime scene? Unless Michelle was the killer. As Deputy First Assistant Prosecutor Lavaca said, she dumped his body in a creek, like a piece of trash, but she left behind one telling clue, this blanket. Another babysitter, Dawn Matthews, also identified the blanket as the same one she had seen while looking after Timmy when she was around 15 years old. This made three separate witnesses who could identify the blanket found discarded with Timmy's body as coming from inside Michelle's home. Throughout the investigation, Michelle had always claimed that she was a loving mother to Timmy, and during the trial, this was questioned by Mary Ellen Quirk, the former school nurse at Timmy's school. She was called to the witness stand where she recalled how Timmy was either late or absent for almost half of his first year at school. She told the court that when Michelle dropped Timmy off, she never hugged him or kissed him. She just sent him on his way.
You said you saw Timmy when you dropped him off, or when he would be late and he would be dropped off in your office. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Did you see Michelle Lodzinski?
Yes.
Okay. Can you describe how it is that she interacted, when she interacted with her son?
Michelle was quiet, not a lot of hugging. Most parents do. She would just drop them off at me.
Thank you, I have nothing further.
The court was next to hear testimony from Laura Machowski, who was at the carnival on the evening that Timmy disappeared. She told the jury that she had struck up a conversation with Michelle at a food stand, noting that Michelle was on her own. Laura could even recollect exactly what Michelle had been wearing that evening. She said that there was no sign of Timmy, nor did Michelle even mention him. One of the most pivotal moments of the trial was when the many interviews with Michelle were played out in court. These tapes took the courtroom back 25 years ago. In these tapes, the jury could hear just how many times Michelle changed her story as to what took place at the carnival. From claiming that she had just turned her back on Timmy for a moment, to claiming he was abducted by a woman named Ellen, these tapes were certainly damning to Michelle's case.
The statement you gave to the Sayreville Police Department on May 26th is correct for all other information other than the facts and circumstances surrounding this, the actual disappearance of Timothy while at the carnival.
Yeah. Okay.
After you gave Timmy the tickets and Ellen agreed to watch Timmy while you went to get your soda, did you subsequently leave Timmy with her so that you could get your soda?
Yeah.
Do you recall whether there were any other parties with Ms. Ellen.
No, and a little girl.
On May 25th of this year, did you report your son, Timothy Wiltsy, age 5, as a missing person to the Sarajevo Police Department?
Yeah.
And at that time, did you make statements to the police surrounding the facts and circumstances of his disappearance to the police?
Yeah.
The following morning, on the 26th, did you subsequently give a formal statement to the Sarajevo Police Department concerning the facts and circumstances surrounding the disappearance of Timothy?
Yeah.
Were the facts and circumstances you related to the police in that statement correct?
Yeah.
In the taped interviews, Michelle's demeanor was ever-changing, and she was often uncooperative, even storming out of the interview on several occasions and daring the investigators to arrest her. Her disposition certainly didn't portray her as an innocent mother, but instead as a mother with something to hide. By this point in the trial, the jury was still questioning what motivation could Michelle have had to kill her own son. Michelle's brother's ex-girlfriend, Danielle Marcus, was the first to hint at a motivation when it was her time to take the stand. She told the jury that Timmy had been having medical issues, and these issues were proving to be a problem for Michelle. She said, "The older he got, the more medical problems he was having. It was harder for her. You could just tell." Danielle also told the jury that she once heard Michelle say, "I'm a weekend mom. I'm not made for this shit."
He was on her way. She was very young. She was a young mom. She went out often, very often. There was times when she never came home. When I babysat, I was a teenager, and he would spend the night at my parents' house with my mom having to take off the next day from work. And her sister wanted him to go live in Florida with her when she moved there, and Michelle wouldn't let him. And probably if she did let Timmy go with her sister, he'd probably still be alive today.
Michelle's defense team attempted to argue that Timmy's death could have been accidental. They also attempted to argue that somebody else could have killed Timmy and called 42-year-old Damien Dowdle, a convicted bank robber, to the stand. Damien told the jury that he lived with Bernard Joseph McShane in Arizona for several years. The two men went on the run by early 1991, having been charged with robbing a video store. Damien claimed that Bernard told him that he had went to Atlantic City or Atlanta City, where he killed a young boy. According to Damien, Bernard said that he had followed this young boy into the woods and had planned on molesting him. However, when the young boy started to scream and fight back, Bernard strangled him.
He told me that while he was out, he was at a park with a big event going nearby. And while he was at that park, a boy had gone into the woods, and there was some sort of an argument, and the boy went into the woods, and Joe either followed him or whatever, but ended up trying to molest this kid. And
did he tell you specifically what he did to the child?
Yeah, I mean, if memory serves me, he didn't actually get to molest the kid, because in the process of it, I think he had pulled down the kid's pants or whatever and was fondling him. The kid began screaming and crying, and he got concerned that people were nearby and there was a search going on under for this kid. So he wanted to shut the kid up, and he strangled him.
Did he tell you about the strangulation itself?
Well, yeah, he said that he strangled the kid. He said that he was afraid that this kid's cries were going to bring people to where he was at, and he strangled him. I mean, I didn't want to hear any greater detail than that.
Did you understand that he killed this child?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It wasn't, I knocked him out. It wasn't, I put my hand over his mouth to hush him or something like that, and the kid stopped breathing. He strangled him to stop him from being able to make noise.
The defense had anticipated that this new suspect would cast doubt on the accusation that Michelle had murdered Timmy. However, it fell extremely short of their expectations. Bernard was called to testify as a rebuttal witness and denied that he had any involvement in the death of Timmy. He also denied ever claiming that he had killed anybody to Damien.
Did you tell him that at an event in a park, you witnessed some kind of fight or disagreement among what appeared to be a family?
No.
Did you tell him that a little boy associated with that group of people ran away and ran into the woods?
No.
Did you tell him that you caught up with that little boy in the woods?
No.
Did you tell him that you started to molest that little boy?
No.
Did you tell him that you pulled down his pants?
No.
Did you tell him that people were looking for that little boy?
No.
Did you tell him that the little boy was screaming and crying?
No.
Did you tell him that you got scared that people might be hearing the boy as they were looking for him?
No.
Did you tell him that you hit and strangled the little boy?
No.
And that you killed him?
No.
He said that the last time he spoke to Damien was when they were both in the recreation yard of an Arizona jail in 1991. He also told the jury that he had never been in New Jersey and was in Georgia at the time of Timmy's disappearance. Following this testimony, the jury were sent away to deliberate. After several days of deliberation, the jury reached a verdict for Michelle.
How do you find, as to count one of the indictment charging defendant Michelle Lisinski on or between May 25, 1991 and April 23, 1992 in the city of South Amboy and or the borough of Sayreville and or the township of Edison and or other municipalities within the county of Middlesex, aforesaid, and or other municipalities all within the jurisdiction of the court, did purposely or knowingly cause the death of Timothy Woolsey, or did purposely or knowingly cause seriously bodily injury to Timothy Woolsey, resulting in his death?
Guilty.
They found Michelle Lodzinski guilty of the murder of Timmy. As the verdict was read out, Michelle began to shake. She didn't say a word. The guilty verdict for Michelle Lodzinski came 9,125 days after she first reported Timmy missing. Declaring that Michelle will be old and grey when she is released, the judge sentenced her to 30 years in prison. Investigators, locals, and even some family members believed for decades that Michelle was involved in her son's disappearance and murder. And at long last, they finally had closure and justice. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. Thank you so, so much for listening. I decided to redo this episode because my hosting skills have improved a lot since this episode first came out in 2019. I'm in the process of re-recording all of my old episodes, so you may notice a difference in the quality of some episodes as well as the hosting. If you enjoy Morbidology and want exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which come out every month, ad-free and early release episodes, and of course my undying love, then please feel free to check out Morbidology on Patreon. I'd also love if you subscribed on Apple Podcasts and left a review. Reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.